This is a State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. It's been almost a year since Hurricane Florence slammed into North Carolina's coast. In the aftermath of any major storm, the focus is usually on the material needs of communities, like food, clothing, and shelter. But what about the less visible things, like how people are grieving and coping? Lonnie Crum and Janae Avent Harris conduct research on mental health in rural eastern North Carolina. They've looked at how Hurricane Florence and other devastating storms have shaped individuals and their communities. They're both licensed counselors and professors in the College of Education at ECU, and they join me in studio now. Lonnie, welcome back.
Hi, Anita. Thank you for having me.
And Janae, welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm so glad to be here.
So, Lonnie, at this point after a disaster, there's not a lot of news coverage that spans the state about what things look like on the ground. Can you paint us a picture from your perspective about what's happening in terms of hurricane aftermath right now?
Okay, sure. So hurricane season began in the Atlantic region in June, but for many North Carolina residents, it seemed like it never ended. The frequency of hurricanes that hit our regions leaves residents homeless, jobless, and in need of government services. And for many of us that live in our region, some of us are still reaching and seeking those resources. The schools, I know, are working on repairs and hoping that they'll meet the August deadline for students to return to normalcy.
So as we said in the introduction, Janae, mental health can take a back seat. Can you talk about how hurricanes can exacerbate mental health conditions or the relationship between disaster and mental health?
Sure. I always think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it talks about, you know, we have to have those basic needs met first. So food, shelter, that type of thing, before we can begin discussing self-actualization, being self-aware, things like that. And so during a hurricane, it really is like, how do we meet people's immediate needs? And we don't always think about there's trauma, there's grief and loss. And particularly in our region, those things are compounded because we tend to have hurricanes back to back. And so people never have a chance to fully recover from one before there's another devastation that occurs. And so I think we see a lot of depression, we see a lot of anxiety, but we see a lot of that being suppressed as well because you're kind of in preparation mode. Like Lonnie said, we're already preparing for the next season.
This is something that you're personally really familiar with based on your experience growing up in this area and the story of your own family. Can you take us into that a little bit and kind of give us a sense of what this re-traumatization can look like?
Yeah, so 1999, Hurricane Floyd was pretty devastating on our area. And I remember my house flooding. I think I was in eighth grade at the time. And so it was a lot of how do we just get by? I remember we stayed with my uncle for about 6 months. So we were displaced. Luckily, we had somewhere to go, but we were displaced for about 6 months. I remember our school year was interrupted. And even now, as I think about being an adult, those things still sit with me. So if it rains really hard right now, I get a little nervous. When I see like flash flooding in the streets, I get a little nervous. And so I think about people who have lost their homes multiple times. If you think about Princeville, people there have lost their homes multiple times, and what it's like to have to relive these hurricane seasons and relive, like, even heavy rain can be re-traumatizing. When we did some disaster relief at the Hurricane Matthew, one of the things that occurred to me is what's the difference between now and then is that we get to see stuff in real time. So when I was losing my home in Hurricane Floyd, we left the house and I didn't know what it looked like until we got back. Well, with our technology, which is a good thing, social media, people are seeing their homes being destroyed very much in real time, and that's re-traumatizing in itself. So with technology comes some changes in how we need to think about how we respond during these disasters.
Lonnie, tell me, you've been doing research and looking into people's personal experiences since the hurricane. Tell me a bit about what you've heard and found so far.
What I've found from my studies, actually, I was thinking about just continuing this study because the findings have been so prolific, was the impact it has on special populations such as those who are differently able and the elderly, being that they are not able to relocate when a storm is impinging the area, or our shelters set up to have people with autism or the elderly or with wheelchair access. And that came about after Hurricane Florence, actually, as one of my findings in my research. And also the impact on children and adolescents. As we know from my research and previous others, environmental grief and stress causes marital problems and extreme financial problems. And this is particularly impactful in rural regions who already experience some social and economic deprivation.
So when we talk about these rural regions, for people that live far away, it may be hard to get a full picture of what mental health infrastructure actually looks like there. Are there community health clinics? Who are the people that are providing mental health services?
Right. Thank you for bringing that up, because I am an advocate for rural mental health. And what we know is that we are very underserved and under-resourced in rural regions. Usually a rural community, rural remote, meaning they could be an hour, 2 hours away from a city or a town even, is that sometimes they have no mental health representation at all. And some of our counselors have to travel or to provide home-based counseling to those counties. So their cars are their work offices. And if they do, usually it's the school counselor that is the only school counselor in the district, in the entire school. So it's very minimal, the mental health resources in rural communities.
Janae, the church is sometimes a place that steps in and serves as both a place where people can seek support as well as kind of the first line of defense for people who may be struggling with mental health. Talk about your research into the church and their role in these situations.
Yeah, I think the church is very vital. Historically, particularly in rural areas and other underserved populations, it's been the only place that people can go for solace, support, that type of thing. And even today, I think it still remains one of the most relevant institutions because it does a lot of the resourcing. It's where people can gather, it's where people can get support. I think our work now is how do we integrate mental health training with churches so that they know how to respond, even if you think about disasters, right? How do they respond to those mental health needs after disaster has happened? Then I think we need to train counselors on how to be able to hold spaces for people who come from these faith institutions and when their faith is very important to them.
Tell me about that training. What are you trying to train pastors to be able to do?
A lot. No, I think it's very important that you know how to recognize when there is a mental health issue. How do we respond to crises? If someone is dealing with suicidal ideation, what are the appropriate responses? You know, a lot of times in churches, there's a kind of knee-jerk reaction to pray, and I think that can be important. But we also need to know what proper protocols and procedures need to be in place so that person can get the support and the help that they need. And so a lot of that is baseline crisis training, and then some more training on how do we listen? Like, how do we ask open-ended questions? How do we honor people's feelings?
You've also looked at this interesting relationship between theology and how people mm-hmm. share their experiences of pain. Can you tell us about that and how that fits into this picture?
Yeah, so I think that and I did not go to seminary, so a lot of I'm learning as I study, but we get our ideas about suffering based on whatever theological kind of supposition that we tend to connect with. And so that could be like what songs our church sings. It could be what messages our pastors preach, but we understand suffering through that lens. And so there may be some people who say, hey, suffering is a part of life. I don't need to do anything about it. Suffering is a reward. That's how I get my reward. And so they may not be as likely to present for counseling if they kind of conceptualize suffering like that, versus those who understand, like, we have to live here. And then, yeah, we may go to heaven later, but we have to live here. And how do we live our best lives here?
Talk about, Lonnie, living here and what it means for communities who stay in place. There is kind of a common perception maybe from people that live outside of these areas that, okay, you're suffering these instances year after year. Why do you stay?
Right. And that's a big concern that has come up multiple times in my conversation with residents, is that from outsiders, it seems like there is an aura of complacency that we live in these regions that we know are in flood zones. However, generationally, that's where our roots are. And when living in these rural communities, there's a sense of communal pride. And there was a theory is called conservation of resources. That's protecting what you have. And if we were to, if some of our residents were to relocate, where would they go if most of their family is from Princeville or is from Pollocksville, one of these small communities? So that it's not that they're complacent, is that, that there's a lot of pride and comfort in these communities and assets. Where would we go? There's nowhere to go. Also, finances also play a part in being able to relocate. Do you relocate to the community shelter or can you afford a hotel in Virginia? So people have to look at the economic reasons and relocation. And on top of that, elderly people with dementia, they're really hard to be mobile in urgent or crisis situations. So there are a variety of reasons why people choose to remain here.
The two of you both are from the areas that you serve and that you research. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what you've learned about stigma and its role in mental health treatment and access.
Sure. I think we've learned that stigma is prevalent and that unfortunately, although I think we've made some gains, there's still a lot of stigma that exists. And so I feel very connected to the work that we do here because we are from here. So I'm very invested in the area and I think there are a lot of opportunities. And so Dr. Crum always challenges me to take a strength-based kind of approach to these things. And so instead of looking at it as like what's wrong, it's like there's a lot of opportunities for community stakeholders to get involved. And how do we reduce stigma? How do we make mental health more accessible for people? How do we make it more culturally responsive so we can't expect people to go get help if they're not honored, if their identities are not honored? And so I think there's a lot of work for all of us mm-hmm. to do to make it destigmatized and more accessible.
And validating what their concerns may be. Anxiety is normal before, during, and after a natural disaster. That doesn't mean that I have a problem that, you know, that's internal to me. Most of your community is experiencing some level of anxiety. So that comes with the literacy and the post-disaster symptoms, recognizing depression, anxiety, stress, heightened marital issues, you know, recognizing that, owning it, and it being okay whether you talk to your clergy or your coworkers or a trained mental health professional, but normalize these stressors that follow natural disasters.
Have you learned any best practices for mental health as communities prepare for an impending storm? Mm-hmm. Other things? I mean, Janae, you mentioned don't watch the TV of the floodwaters rising as you're in your shelter. That seems like a really clear step people can take. Are there other things that you've come to realize through your research?
Two very important that even preparing for this interview, I watched people at the CDC say, be careful of how much news media you consume before and after. Consume enough to know what's the imminent situation around you. But even for children, do not let them watch the continuous coverage because that can cause stress, panic, and anxiety. And when we're in a panic mode, we aren't as fruitful in our reactions. Also, I am a big proponent of being proactive. We know it's not if it's going to happen again. It's going to happen. It's when. And being proactive, having safety plans, talking about your emotions and your feelings and your finances. Have you recovered from Florence? Have you recovered from Floyd, Matthew? So just having these open conversations to prepare, even school systems. What will we do if we're 3 months or 3 weeks out of school? What is the plan for our students and our teachers and relocation and our school buses? But everyone can be more proactive in across our state in preparing for these storms.
There's also a role that providers need to play in creating space in a very particular kind of way when they're talking with people who have experienced trauma. I think one of you mentioned in an interview talking with a client who said, you know, I lost my back door, but I didn't even have a front door yet. Right. Tell me that story and kind of what it taught you about how to interact with people who are experiencing this kind of trauma.
Right. And I think this might have happened in an interview that I had in Wilmington. It was a school counselor and she was working with a young person. And she was saying that, well, tell me your outcome from the storm. Tell me how your family fared. And a little girl said, oh, I think we were okay. And she knew that the little girl was in the hardest places. And she was like, well, we never had a back door anyway. So I think like the roof was blown off, but we just put some tarp over it. So recognizing the socioeconomic situations that people are in previously. And for the little girl, I mean, she didn't take on, I'm sure that her parents definitely knew the situation, but she was like, well, it's okay. Our roof is gone, but we didn't have a back door anyway. So as the adult, being able to assess sometimes on their behalf what they may need.
That even if they don't present right away with a lot of concerns, being able to create space for them to explain the bigger context that they're living in.
Right, and which is very important for schools, teachers, and anyone in helping professionals, even our rescue workers, is to be able to go ahead and start those conversations now. How are you feeling about hurricane season coming up? How is your family? Because our professional workers, our rescue workers also have a lot of anxiety, and they're on the front lines with looking at most of the devastation that we don't even see or that the news media doesn't pick up. So making sure that they're in these conversations and being attuned to their mental health as well.
We talked about anxiety, depression. You've touched on PTSD a little bit. Are there other mental health concerns that you're looking at that people tend to commonly experience?
Well, those are the primary ones associated with natural disasters. However, I'm in the belief that that any mental health disorder that you have, whether treated or untreated, trauma or traumatic situations can exacerbate those symptoms. So it's very important that whether treated or untreated, if you have a diagnosed mental disorder and you're getting treatment, let them know, and you live in a flood-prone area, go ahead and start having those conversations with your provider, because trauma does exacerbate these things. And adverse childhood experiences, natural disasters, is actually one of the factors that leads to long-term trauma.
Aside from churches, are there other community institutions in which you all are working to create infrastructure to better support communities in the aftermath of disasters?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we try to take a perspective on is that it can be family, school, and community partnerships. And so how do we get all the stakeholders involved? Community business leaders, right? How do we get them having this conversation about disaster relief and helping prepare for that? And like Dr. Crum said, schools and even families. So I think that there needs to be an all-hands-on-deck approach, that everyone has an invested interest in seeing our communities do well. And that means having these hard conversations and investing the necessary resources into preparing people for natural disasters and also being there to support them after it's happened.
Are there attempts to recruit and get more mental health service providers in these areas? And what does that look like?
Absolutely. That's my everyday job. Well, my first line of defense right now is to bring mental health first aid training, rule specific to all of our regions across North Carolina. So we are actively working on grants to be able to provide funding for those sources. And when we have to have those grants, we hope to travel across the state offering these at schools, community, churches, and businesses for everyone involved to get that professional training on how to be proactive and reactive following the whole recovery stage of a hurricane.
I'd love to end talking a little bit more about community assets. You mentioned the extreme resilience that you see in the people that you're working with, this ability to band together as a church family and support people. Can you talk about some other examples of really strong assets that you've seen in the people who you're listening to?
I think one of the most phenomenal stories from my research with Florence was that before the schools were back in, the teachers connected on social media. And they were holding not classes, but informal learning groups at churches and at some of the restaurants that were open. So their kids who were preparing for EOGs, or particularly their seniors who are preparing for SATs and ACTs, they wouldn't lose that. So they were bringing resources from their homes and meeting in the local community to make sure that these students were still prepared to take their exams. And I think that that's rural connectedness and community and caring that you don't get much anywhere else.
I agree. I think people are our greatest resources. I think it was Matthew in particular, I was at Ward Tabernacle Church and helping out with their disaster relief. And just to see the people who came to help, the people who said, like, I wasn't impacted. I want to bring water. What can I bring? And so I always believe that people are your greatest resources. I'm so proud to be from this area because I have seen people respond to both my family personally and then when I got in this role as a professional.
Thank you both so much for sharing your research and experience. We will continue to follow the work that you're doing as you follow the aftermath in these communities. Lonnie Crum and Janae Avent Harris are licensed counselors and professors in the College of Education at ECU. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the history of the first beachfront community in North Carolina where African Americans could own property. Ocean City Beach. We'll go there when we continue our conversation on the state of things. I'm Anita Rao. Please stay with us.